I was talking, Malcolm, I need to talk to you. No, because I'm calling the meeting to order. But I do today, okay? I'm calling the bark to order. I almost brought my dog so we'd have a mascot, but there we go. That's how we'll call it to order from now on. We all bark. So when we do the roll, if you're here, bark. And if you're not here, just be silent. Actually, we're not doing the roll. So I'm calling it to order. First thing, is there anybody of the committee that would like to say anything? Anybody have anything burning? Committee comment? Okay, public comment, time in which you can speak to anything that's not on today's agenda. Seeing lack of public. Can I get an approval of the Joint Policy Committee meeting, formerly known, now known as BARC, for March 20th? It was moved by Pierce, I believe, and it was seconded by Sperring. Is there any objection to the motion? The motion will pass without objection, and we're aware of everybody who's here, so it'll be correct. Okay. We will start off. One of the things that I thought would be good that we do in the future is just kind of get a little update from each member agency as to what's exciting that may affect us. And so we'll start with Ezra Rapport from ARAG for a brief update on what him and his board is up to.
With respect to the agenda of the BARC, right?
Well, I would hope you would stay on topic.
Yes, I'm going to stay on topic.
If you stray, that's fine, but...
So I guess one of the key components that we do for the region is we work with FEMA to do the hazard mitigation plan, which connects to local governments with respect to their risks. And in the past, the way it was done was you looked at past things that occurred, and then you look at present hazards. And we're now moving that topic to future hazards. So that allows us to look much more closely at the climate change adaptation program. And FEMA is very interested in supporting that, as well as extending potentially the grant to be multi-year. So we would then have a more of a partnership with the federal government on looking at adaptation issues. So we think that's a major improvement over the way the system works today. Another key thing that occurred was that I actually read the Bay Area Council Surviving the Storm report, which I thought was pretty entertaining. One of the concepts that they had there that was new to me was this idea of paleohydrology, which looks back in the past at these incredible atmospheric river floods that absolutely no flood control system could contain. So it's as bad as the big one for the earthquake. And so that wasn't too much fun. But then they also mentioned another term called PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is why we haven't had any sea level rise in the Bay Area for the last 27 years, is because of that. But that's not a permanent state. It tends to come and go. So when it goes, sea level rise is likely to occur at a much faster rate than the sort of linear 1-2 inches as it goes. I probably stole some of Larry's thunder here.
You're doing great.
I'm doing great.
You going to teach physics?
Anyway, those are two entertaining parts of the Surviving the Storm report that we're taking into account as we go forward with our resilience strategy.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Ezra? With that, we will move to Jack Broadbent from the Air District.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a considerable amount of work underway at the Air District these days. For those of you that probably have seen this in the paper, we are updating our wood smoke rule, working on a refinery strategy. We're transitioning our bike share over to MTC. But let me talk to you a little bit about some of the related efforts that overlap and affect the BARC. They include the fact that we are updating our clean air plan. Our clean air plan is essentially the blueprint on how we will seek to be able to achieve our state and federal ambient air quality standards and continue to reduce emissions here in the Bay Area. That plan will be brought before our board, we think, around the mid 2016 timeframe, and we would plan to bring that back through the BARC tier, of course. Now, integral as part of that plan, though, is a part of it, a very key part of it, is our climate protection strategy. And I just wanted to take a moment, Mr. Chairman, just talk a little bit about the conversation and dialogue that's going on at the Air District, because I think it relates to the BARC. We have a considerable amount of authority as it relates to air emissions, and there is a lot of folks in the community groups that are pushing on the Air District these days to be able to apply that authority as it relates to greenhouse gases. And what we've done as staff is we have responded by conducting a gap analysis. We have been looking at national programs, the state's AB 32 program, looking at what cities and counties are undertaking with regard to here in the Bay Area, working very closely with our sister agencies. And that gap analysis will be essentially key to developing our own strategy that we will be bringing back to our board this summer. So essentially what we're talking about at the Air District is being able to regulate greenhouse gases. And this is actually something we have not done to date. We believe we've reduced greenhouse gases through our control program by reducing emissions that cause smog and that cause toxic air contaminants, but we haven't specifically adopted anything or programs to specifically reduce greenhouse gases, and that's what we're talking about. That's a very important step that we're going to take here very soon so that we can complement the state AB 32 program. The board's very aware of this, and we think our first step will be to incorporate a greenhouse gas reduction strategy as part of our refinery rules that we're bringing before the board this summer. We've put together a staff of 7 to staff up our climate protection program. Abby Young is our new manager of this effort, and so we're going to take that staff, and it'll be important in terms of really moving the program forward at the Air District as we move forward. So as these initiatives and plans and regulations, Mr. Chairman, we'll bring it back to the BARC so that this group has an understanding of where the district is moving with regard to our climate protection program. And with that, that's my report.
Thank you. Any questions of Jack? So how popular has that wood smoke ordinance been for you?
Well, you'll hear a report about it next week. Yeah, it's real,
all
real
right.
Popular.
So Larry Goldsplan from BCDC. Would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few things to report. Last month, I had the pleasure of accompanying Steve Heminger and Bijan Sartipi of Caltrans to Secretary Kelly's office to talk with him about the need for BCDC and MTC to work together with Caltrans and Secretary Kelly's funds to do adapting to rising tides projects throughout and around the Bay. And since we figured that about 40% or so of the assets that would be protected through an adapting to rising tides program are transportation related, Steve was kind enough to arrange the meeting, and we are hopeful that at some point in the next few months, I would hope, we get an approval from the Secretary. And we also want to thank Steve for ponying up funds as well to do art around the Bay. And so I think it's a great example of how we can cooperate bilaterally. Speaking of the Adapting to Rising Tides program, we are about to have our second huge meeting in Contra Costa County, thanks in great part to Supervisor Joya, as our folks work with local cities and county planners and private sector folks, including folks from Chevron and others, to make sure that everybody understands what the vulnerabilities are along the shoreline in Contra Costa County and can start working on adapting to them. With regard to BARC's upcoming move to 375 Beale, we are happy to report two things. Number one, the Senate Budget Committee provided intent language, for lack of a better term, saying that BCDC as a state agency ought to be moving to 375 Beale as soon as possible, which is always a nice thing to see. And the second nice piece of news is that the Attorney General's office, which is located a few floors above us in the State Building, has not only toured BCDC's offices, but has told the state that they want to move into them as soon as possible, which means that one of the big hurdles of moving basically is over. So we are hoping to provide you with even more information upcoming. Finally, a couple things that I want to let you know are happening. Mark Stacey, who is a phenomenal engineering professor at Cal, who is working on what we call Bay Model 2.0, which is essentially a new way to look at the bay, a new model which allows, in very simple terms, one to figure out what happens if you put a levee here to the space over here biologically, and what happens if you do something over here and how that affects turbidity over here, is working hard on his presentation, which has been seen a few places and will be seen at BCDC next month. We are going to pair him with Warner Chabot, the head of the San Francisco Estuary Institute, because they are working on, just as Mark is looking at bathymetry, they're looking at topology along the bay, and we want to make sure that they're talking so that they can integrate ultimately what they're working on. And then Christina Hill from Cal received the first Climate Readiness Institute grant and is going to be working on adaptation planning projects and trying to figure out what is scalable and how we should figure out what is scalable, and with all those projects that Bruce Reardon had listed last year. And so I just want to make sure you all know that those kinds of projects are going on, and we will be sharing the results with you.
That's some pretty good news. I guess Assemblymember Bill Dodd was right when he said, if you build it, they will come. So looks like you will now be coming. So that's great.
We're not counting our chickens yet, but we are certainly cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, no, I think that's very encouraging news. Steve Heminger from MTC.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I apologize. Go ahead.
No problems. Jake McKenzie from Sonoma County. Just a piece of information. The four counties, Solano, Napa, Sonoma, and Marin, met in, I guess you would say, solemn conclave a couple of weeks ago in Petaluma, and we were lawyered up with our general counsels. And those four entities are going to propose to their respective Board of Supervisors that we establish a memorandum of understanding. The reason I bring this up is it deals with rising tides, and it particularly deals with a transportation corridor, which is generally identified as Highway 37. And so just as Contra Costa is moving forward in that direction, it looks like we are going to start moving actively in the direction of identifying that Highway 37 transportation corridor as a focus of our interests in the decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Any questions? Steve?
Thank you. I was going to mention three things, but I think I'll give you a little construction update on Beale Street at the end, since it is affecting all the agencies one way or the other. First, starting with very good news in Sacramento this week, where the governor basically doubled the amount of cap-and-trade money available in next year's budget based on the success of the auctions. And that means that for the four transportation programs that are nested within it, they will be doubled as well, which means we've got more money to shoot at. The high-speed rail program gets more money, and we're going to try to lighten their load a little bit by scarfing some of that up for the electrification of Caltrain on the peninsula, which the state's already made a $600 million commitment to, but we need a little bit more because it's going to cost a little bit more. There's a formula program for local transit operations that will see a bump, and that formula is very favorable to the Bay Area, so that's good news, especially for us. And then there are two other programs, one on transit and intercity rail, and the other on sustainable communities, essentially, where the commission is actually going to be weighing in and recommending projects. We don't get to pick them, even though we would have preferred that model, perhaps. But we are going to recommend to the agencies that will, the California Transportation Agency, as well as the Strategic Growth Council. And in terms of the Strategic Growth Council programs, we did quite well in terms of being invited to submit applications. We were invited to submit about 40% of the applications statewide, which is good news for us and made LA pretty mad. So we've got to keep an eye on making sure everybody is at least marginally happy with the status quo so that folks don't try to change what the law says. But all in all, it's very good news and is actually consistent with our long-range plan and what we assume we'll be able to draw from cap and trade for many years to come. The second, Jack mentioned briefly, and I'll just mention it a little bit more, which is bike share, and it's a pretty big deal. What we're contemplating is a tenfold increase in the Bay Area bike share program, and even better than that, it will be free. So there may be no free lunch, but there may be free bikes, and the program will primarily be concentrated in the largest cities in the region. But the commission is scheduled to consider a proposal at the end of the month that would not only accept the proposal from the private firm that's suggesting it, but also set aside some public funds to continue the program in the pilot cities on the peninsula, as well as to offer it to what we're calling emerging communities who might like to start up a bike share program in the future. So that seems to be on a pretty good path towards success, but we have a commission action at the end of the month and then a negotiation finally with the contractor on the contract, and we'll move ahead from there.
If I could, I think it's free in terms of our subsidies, but it's not free in terms of the bike user, right?
Oh, no, it's certainly not. They'll have to pay to use it. That's why the private company's proposing it. They're going to get their money from the users, and they're going to get their money by branding the program, similar to what you see around the world. So in London, it's Barclays, and in New York, it's Citibank. I think one important thing to note is that the commission does get to approve who they give it to so that they don't give it to some scoundrel. So that's item number two. The third is maybe a little bit off subject for this group, but I think it's worth mentioning to you, and that is in June we'll be bringing to the commission the first construction contract for building our express lane network in the Bay Area. And that will put MTC in an unusual position. Instead of getting mad at Dan for not picking up the cones in time, he'll be able to get mad at us because we'll be out there in the right-of-way actually getting the work done. And we do believe this way of managing our highway capacity is really the wave of the future, where instead of just adding capacity and offering it out to anybody free of charge, basically we'll be in the early phase converting all the carpool lanes in the region to express lanes, and the carpoolers keep using them like nothing changed, but single-occupant motorists can buy their way into them if they want to get a faster trip. And they've proven very effective where they've been tried. What we're really trying to do is to stitch together a network so people can use it throughout the region, not only carpools but express buses as well. And finally, on the building, our big impediment was getting the Drug Enforcement Administration out of the building, and they are gone. We're now trying to ding them for rent, and we'll see how good we're doing on that. But the fact that they're out of there now means that we could really put the pedal to the metal on the rehabilitation work. And so we've cleared out their piece of the eighth floor where they were squatting. We've got a lot of work underway right now on multiple fronts. The big news this month will be we put an atrium into the building, stem to stern, top to bottom. And we've had a sort of artificial rain prevention cap at the top, and that's going to be removed later this month. So you'll really see the effect of all that natural light coming into the facility. So for those of you who haven't seen it for a while, I'd probably recommend a trip over in June because you'll see all that light in there. And the Air District floor, the sixth floor of the building is all Air District. That floor is the furthest one along, and so it is quite far along in terms of giving you a sense of what the whole place is going to look like when we open it up. And we are still on schedule to finish construction in December of this year. So we're going as fast as we can, and we're looking forward to it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Steve? Dan, do you have anything you'd like to share? I know I'm kind of catching you off guard, but.
Well, thank you, Chair Hagerty. I'm Dan McLean. I'm your Chief Deputy District Director for Caltrans in the Bay Area, and also sitting in on a regular basis for State Transportation Agency. And Secretary Kelly has been quite ready and available for us, and we've got, as Larry's mentioned, some opportunities there working with the Transportation Agency. So as we move through this year, it's going to be very exciting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Dan? Seeing none, we're now going to move to item six, and we're very fortunate today to have somebody from the Governor's Office of Planning and Research to join us, Louise Bedsworth. She's going to talk to us about Governor Brown's executive order reducing greenhouse gases and climate adaptation. So, Louise, welcome, and it's yours.
Great. Well, thank you very much for inviting me here today. And I have a few slides, but I'm also just going to talk through a bit about what the executive order does, how it fits with existing policy that we had, and I think really builds on it in exciting ways for moving forward. So I'm sure, you know, as all of you are aware, California has taken a very comprehensive approach to addressing climate change, really built around three pieces that are interconnected, but really around our AB 32 and longer-term emission reduction goals, and our efforts to prepare for the impacts of climate change, and then a really comprehensive research program that supports both of these efforts. And so all of these pieces fit together on the slides I show you. You know, just in the last year, we've produced three comprehensive updates, one to the scoping plan, the first update to the California Climate Adaptation Strategy called Safeguarding California, and then just recently released a research plan, which really looks at and builds off of these documents and where should the state be investing on research. And so Executive Order B-3015, which was released right at the end of last month, really builds on all of those elements and I think takes us in exciting new directions. And so as you've probably heard quite a bit about, it does confirm and put a path towards reaching our 2050 target, which is to get 80% below 1990 emissions by 2050, and establishes a 2030 target, which would put us 40% below 1990 emissions by 2030. And in the slides, I have a little graph that shows that trajectory. And I think the key there was when you looked at where we were today and getting to 2020, we're on a downward trajectory. To get to 2050, we need to get on a much steeper path. And that 2030 target puts us on that steeper path and actually is slightly below linear. So it means we're getting slightly more emission reductions early on, which when you think about cumulative emissions in the atmosphere is a good thing. And so it gets us on to that steeper path going, going forward. And so that's one big piece of this executive order. As I'm sure many of you are aware, there's also a number of pieces of legislation moving forward, but this really gets us, and the scoping plan update laid out this issue that we need a target, and so this puts us on that path. The other piece of the executive order that I think is also really, really important and really charts out some new, more prescriptive ground forces on the area of adaptation and resilience. And so when you look at the pieces there, the executive order calls for several things to happen. One is a regular update to the Safeguarding California plan, that happened every 3 years. That document really focuses on state agencies and state the state itself is doing to prepare for climate impacts. So it also calls for all state sector groups, which are built around state agencies, to develop implementation plans for Safeguarding California. Those are to be developed by this fall. So it's by September. And they're going to say, how are they going to implement and meet the goals and objectives that are laid out in Safeguarding California, and then report back to the California Natural Resources Agency on their progress in implementing those plans. It also calls out some specifics about how we approach safeguarding. Another important piece is that the executive order also calls for state agencies to consider climate impacts in all planning and investment. So that is really a very broad statement about thinking not just about our capital outlay, but in how we are planning, the policies we're making, and how we're investing our resources. And I can talk a bit more about that. It also includes that the five-year infrastructure plan needs to consider current and future climate impacts. And then it calls for our office and the governor's office of planning and research to form a technical advisory group that will inform and help and assist state agencies in doing this. So I'll talk about all of these in a little bit more detail. And the final piece is it reaffirms the state's commitment to rigorous and a strong research program to support support the work we're doing on climate. So like I said, it puts us on this path, the steeper path towards 2050. We know from our climate assessments for the state that even under the most optimistic scenario where globally we achieve deep emission reductions, we're experiencing some amount of change. And so I think one thing the executive order does is it lays out a much more detailed path for how we prepare for those impacts and lay specific steps that need to be taken. And that was something, while we had the Safeguarding California plan, we didn't have an implementation mandate the same way we do with AB 32. So as I said, for Safeguarding California, the plan will be updated every 3 years. I think the really big piece of the executive order is the desire to see action happening right away. And so there's a very tight turnaround for our sector leads. So the Safeguarding California plan is organized around sectors, and each of those is led by a sector lead. So we have coastal and ocean, we have public health, we have emergency management, and so on. Each of those groups needs to come together between now and September and develop an implementation plan. Basically, looking at safeguarding, what do we say we need to be doing? How are we going to do all of those things? And I think we've seen a lot of good progress in certain areas, and then there are areas that have been much trickier. And I think a lot of these come up where we need to start coordinating across a couple of these sectors. And so this implementation planning will really look at how are we going to make all of these steps happen. Another important piece that is in the executive order, and I think there are small words here and there that are important to point out, in looking at safeguarding, it talks about identifying vulnerabilities by sector, but also by region. And I think that's an important piece because there's so much work happening at the regional scale, it starts putting us more in a direction of thinking about those regional vulnerabilities and potentially moving the safeguarding plan to also being a regional analysis in the longer term. The work around safeguarding is all led by the California Natural Resources Agency, which is the agency that's always led the development of the Safeguarding California plan. The one thing this Safeguarding California did in this the update from 2014 is it lays out principles for adaptation. These principles are also contained in the executive order. And so I think those are, one is to try to take actions that help to reduce emissions and prepare for climate impact. So trying to look for those win-win strategies, but also in thinking more broadly about multiple benefits of our actions. To take flexible, adaptive approaches that can respond to new information and new data, and you know, just learning by doing, because we know with adaptation we're going to have to be doing some experimenting, that we protect the most vulnerable Californians, and that we prioritize natural infrastructure solutions. And so I think those are principles that are also contained in the executive order. On the five-year infrastructure plan that is included in the executive order, that's an effort that will be led primarily by the Strategic Growth Council, which has a mandate in its the legislation that formed it to review and comment on the five-year infrastructure plan. And so over the last 18 months or so, we've been working, a small working group of us under the Strategic Growth Council with the Department of Finance on the five-year infrastructure plan. And I think that will begin in much more earnest with the SGC really that now working a lot more with agencies to think about how do we represent actually all elements of the executive order in the five-year infrastructure plan submittals. And so I think this will be an evolving process, but I think even now in this the next five-year infrastructure plan, hopefully we will start to see more discussion of these goals and how they relate to our infrastructure investments. And again, I think that is something that will evolve over time. The final piece that I'll mention about the executive order is this technical advisory group. And this is included, and it is under the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, and it's left quite open as to what that will be. But the intention there is to form a very inclusive, transparent group that will assist state agencies in doing the work that they're being asked to do under the executive order. And it will take a couple of roles. One is to be a forcing function as things are moving very quickly in the early period to try to help as available, but then also to look at what happens in these first implementation plans and do try to provide the guidance to help fill in needs that are identified there. We anticipate that membership on this advisory group will include state agencies, local governments, the NGO sector, hopefully the business sector as well, and other stakeholders. So it's intended to be, again, very broad and inclusive. And I imagine, just from our initial thinking about it, it will address several issues, and I'm sure more questions will come up as we have as we form the group. But really, there's a few things. One, the executive order says to account for climate change in all planning and investment. And I think we really need to take a hard look at what does that mean. I think we've thought a lot about infrastructure and capital outlay, and that is one place. But that's only one way the state spends our money. And so how do we lay out and map all of these places that we're talking about where we need to be considering climate change, and what does it mean to do that in those different programs? So really this question of where do we account for climate change? It says all, but I think we need to map that out. Another is how do we account for it? What is the analytical framework to think about climate change across programs? And actually, Caltrans is doing some very interesting work in this area and some others. And so I think there's a lot of work starting that we can try to build a bit of a common framework for state agencies moving forward. And then a question we hear quite a bit is what should we plan for? We produce, I see chuckles, we have some guidance in certain areas, and we produce a lot of climate science information, and so I think this is a challenging question. I spent 3 days in St. Louis at the National Adaptation Forum where people are, you know, climate scientists are wringing their hands saying, but we're giving you these projections. Not everyone knows what to do with them, so I think grappling a bit with that issue. And I'm sure there will be more issues that come up, but I think those are three big ones to start the group off. The intention is really, I think, of this group to be responsive to these needs that come up early on as we really start to, you know, put the pedal to the metal to move these things forward, but then also to be forward-looking and think about, okay, we're here now, where do we want to be in addressing climate change in 5 and 10, 15 years? So that's a bit just in a nutshell on the executive order. I'm sure there's some questions. I also just wanted to mention a few other places where we've been working that are really important for us and I think probably important for the work that you all do. And that's a lot of our work that we've been doing with local and regional governments, which I think will also be very critical in helping us think through the implementation of the executive order. And I'll mention first the work we've been doing with the Alliance of Regional Collaboratives for Climate Adaptation. That is the collaboration of the collaborative of the five collaboratives that are in San Diego, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Sacramento, and the Sierra Nevada region, has really been for us a really helpful resource in trying to make a better connection between what we're doing at the state and what's happening on the ground. And so I think it's been a really helpful partnership in some areas. It's also been helpful for getting information, comment, and input on the work that we're doing. And so just, you know, we sit, the state sits as an ex officio board member, but participates quite closely with ARCA, which I think has been a great partnership between helping make these better connections, because so much is happening at the local and regional level that I think there are places where it's really pushing the state forward. Another program that I'm sure some of you are familiar with is Civic Spark, and that is our AmeriCorps program. It's an AmeriCorps Governor's Initiative that was started. It's in its first year, that has 9 regional hubs throughout the state and is placing AmeriCorps members into local governments to help with climate change planning, both resilience and mitigation planning. It's been a very successful program. We're very excited to see how it's rolled out, and they had very positive feedback from the AmeriCorps members. As I said, it's a regional hub structure, which is somewhat unique, but especially the federal government, has been looking very closely at it and excited about it. And the members have been giving a lot of positive feedback about what's been happening there. It's being administered by the Local Government Commission and was developed in partnership with OPR. I'll also mention the California Adaptation Planning Guide, which I believe is going through some updates right now, but really is one tool we've put out coupled with CalAdapt, our downscale climate information tool, to help local governments to plan for climate change and to really develop a climate adaptation plan. And finally, I'll mention, I'm sure some people have been following this, because it's been happening for quite a while, so we're updating our general plan guidelines at OPR, which had not been comprehensively updated since 2003. When we started the process, we would say 10 years, but now it's 12 years, because if you've been following it, it's taken a lot longer than we originally anticipated. But in doing that, what we're working to do is integrate climate change, both mitigation and adaptation, throughout the entire guidance document. So in every element, think about how does this relate to climate, and in land use and circulation, and really make that a cross-cutting issue throughout the document. We are looking to have a public review draft of that document available later this summer, and so I hope that actually happens. People have stopped asking us when it will come, but it will be here soon. We're getting very close. And there are other issues that we've been grappling with and integrating throughout that. One is health in the built environment and economic development. And so we're trying to weave those themes throughout and also make the document much more accessible and user-friendly in terms of having some best practices, some guides for how you would develop certain elements around our pieces around infill and renewable energy and other pieces like that. So that is coming along shortly. And so I think with that, I think those are, in a nutshell, some of the pieces we've been working on. I think on the executive order that we've been doing, other things I would just mention that I think are important and have implications for the Bay Area is we are in the midst of competing in HUD's National Disaster Resilience Competition. If you haven't heard about this, it's a $1 billion competition with funds that they've aggregated through the Community Development Block Grant Program. And it's the first time they will be awarding these funds through a competitive framework. And the state is our qualified applicant, but you had to enter through a qualifying disaster, which for us was the Rim Fire, which occurred in 2013. And so we've been working very closely with Tuolumne County, the U.S. Forest Service, and a number of state and regional partners to develop a program really looking at forest, watershed health, and community and economic development in a rural community. And I mention that because, as many of you know, that is where San Francisco Public Utilities Commission's watershed is located. And so we've also been in conversation with San Francisco. I think it's a really unique opportunity to make the rural-urban connection and think about resilience at a statewide level through a single project lens. And so we're very excited about that. And hopefully we'll be invited on to phase 2 later on this month or early next month and submitting a final application later this year. So with that, I will...
Okay. Just real quick, and I mean, I don't know how wild this is or not, but you know, this one slide that you show us, Safeguarding California, it shows the burned area. You know, I think that's going to become more of a problem, especially with the drought. So I'm kind of wondering, with this and what the governor's doing, how does the drought play? And then is there any discussion about maybe coastal communities working with desalinization and the state helping with that? Is there anything along those lines happening?
Yeah, I think the water is obviously critical. And I think we've been working a little bit on two fronts. One is on the day-to-day emergency response of the drought, which is playing out in communities across the state every day. And you know, I was on talking to Tuolumne County the other day. They're losing 5 to 10 wells a week. So that's a very near-term urgency type of an issue. I think in a lot of the other work, we're really trying to think on the longer term as well. And so I think that's going to be, it honestly has been, it's a challenge to get to break away from responding to our day-to-day needs of making sure everyone has water and engaging in the longer term. But water is definitely a critical sector within the Safeguarding California plan. And the drought is critical when we think about, of course, wildfire and the other issues that come along with it. And so water is integrated throughout. I think a lot of the work that we're doing, so when we think about land use, and we think about just development in general over the long term. In terms of the coastal communities and desalinization, I know some projects are moving forward. I'm not aware of specific activities in that area, but could certainly find out more from our drought response folks.
Can I guess another question is, because I haven't really thought about this, but you said there was a community that's losing 5 to 10 wells a week, I think mm-hmm. you said. Is this normal to drought, meaning, you know, in the past, I mean, I remember the drought, I think it was like in 76, and I saw that, you know, you see the lakes and they're drying up, but is this drought more critical because we seem to be getting more into the groundwater table, or is this just indicative of all the same droughts and I just didn't know that?
Well, my understanding, I mean, this is a drought of a historic nature. I don't think we've ever seen a drought like this before. And we have a confluence of issues. We have a lot more people. We have groundwater drawdowns. You know, I think this drought is as unprecedented for the state. And I think that, you know, and that's what we're now trying, I think, with the groundwater legislation that was passed last year, and a number of pieces moving forward is really to get a better handle on, because there is science that suggests we could experience more of these types of droughts in the future. And I think we now understand all of the pieces that we need and better handle on understanding groundwater, which we haven't in the past. We haven't had that ability and the data. So I think that's the direction we're moving in. And I think that the legislation from last year is a good example, and that was one of the biggest changes to our water law in a century, if not more. So I definitely think this, we are in uncharted territory.
Yeah. I this probably doesn't really even apply to you, but I just kind of get this off my chest. We have in my district an individual that is selling truckloads of water. He's pulling truckloads of water out of the groundwater, out of the aquifer, and selling them to Arrowhead, which in turn is, you know, selling bottled water. And it's interesting enough because and I mean truckloads, I'm talking like 20 truckloads a day. And it's interesting because Regional Water Quality Control Board is not the one that issues that permit. It's mm-hmm. a different state agency. And I guess if you could help me with that, that would be great, because that's also in our wine region, and the wells are drying up pretty quick mm-hmm. out there. But I got that off my chest, so I feel better. Is there any other questions of Dr. Bedsworth? Jake,
and John. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciated this report. I also appreciate that just now in St. Louis, the National Adaptation forum is meeting. Last year in August, the California Adaptation Forum met to discuss this matter at a state level. And the reason I bring this up is that last month in Sonoma County, we piloted a regional climate adaptation forum. We will be regrouping next week after that forum to develop a county adaptation plan. We already have a climate-ready Sonoma County Hazards and Vulnerabilities Report, which was presented at our forum, and we have the nationally recognized Regional Climate Protection Authority, the first in the nation county organization specifically dedicated towards working on climate protection matters. It is the governance mechanism. It utilizes the Sonoma County Transportation Authority governance mechanism. That being said, Mr. Chair, I think it might be interesting to BARC to hear a presentation on what we are doing in Sonoma County in this matter, because it does present a model. It may not be the model that ends up being adopted, but I would certainly like for it to be considered as a model at the region, within our region, for example, and hopefully statewide. So that's one statement. And very quickly, as the chair of the Local Government Commission, I'm very interested in the Civic Spark program, clearly, since we administer it. And all of these teams that have been mentioned are under our general management. And I believe it might be interesting to this group later on this year to hear how that work is progressing. And I'd be happy to arrange that. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jake. And I've already asked Allison to work with your Sonoma cohorts to come and visit with us and present to us. So, any other, John?
Just appreciate the presentation, appreciate the governor's leadership on moving climate change issues forward. I know there have been some bills to try to implement the governor's executive order. Can you talk briefly about those and where some of them may stand?
Yes, I've been I've been tracking more closely the ones on adaptation pieces than on the targets. So I can't speak, of course, to any of the administration positions on the bills, just that there are a number of pieces moving forward to get long-term targets into statute. There are also bills that would look at trying to formalize adaptation in ways, which is what the executive order tried to do or does. One would be via the Strategic Growth Council and another via the Climate Action Team. And so one of those is a Wieckowski bill and one is a Gordon bill. I can't remember the numbers right now. There's also a bill by Senator Jackson that would require the consideration of climate change in local general plans. It's been going through a lot of conversation. I think the focus in that one was on the safety element of the general plan. And so there is a lot of activity on this, and especially quite a bit of interest on adaptation, which I think is typically has actually not been very successful in the legislature, but also has not been as active, I don't think, as it has the last year or two.
Great. And, of course, we'd always say we appreciate having the dialogue between the governor's office, state, and regional government, especially here, because we're grappling with the same issues regionally. And as you know, with SB, of course, 375, there's a lot of effort here with our SCS and so there's a lot of active work going on.
Which is another area you hear people talking quite a bit about, is the SCS and the regional process as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks. Scott asked me to chair until his return. Any other questions? Mark, and then Jim?
Yeah, one of the challenges in all of this is sustaining an economy that can sustain the adaption. And at one level with as we reduce greenhouse gases, generally means increased cost of energy. And water is obviously one area of adaptation that we need to address. Road infrastructure is another, but I think the energy infrastructure is really critical, and I haven't heard much talk about it. It's one thing to say thou shalt not produce greenhouse gases, but generally that means move to another state for a lot of companies. And so, is there a plan to address the need to continue to provide energy at a reasonable cost so that these businesses can do business, so that we can continue to get the tax revenue needed to actually do the adaptations that are going to be necessary?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we right now have a renewable portfolio standard that gets us to about a third of our electricity being from renewable sources by 2020. We're actually on track to probably exceed that goal. And right now there's a lot of thinking about what does it look like beyond that to clean up our, continue to decarbonize that electricity generation in California. And I think that is merging right now in quite a number of ways with thinking more resiliently, and particularly happening up in rural communities where you can actually tie together a number of different small-scale biomass and other things that are actually quite affordable and achieve multiple benefits in the community, specifically thinking about biomass removal from forests. So I think there's a lot of innovative thinking going on in how we do this, how we contain cost, and how we link together what we're trying to do and link together efforts that we're doing on the energy side with ways to become more resilient. And I think that's critical. So when we look post-Hurricane Sandy, for instance, we saw the value of microgrids and other things like that. So I think there's thinking about that happening in a number of different places. So thinking beyond 2020, we'll have to, as we look at meeting that 2030 target, we'll be evaluating what is the best way to do that at a reasonable cost that achieves our environmental benefits that doesn't harm the state's economy. And there's been a lot of work on that, and the state worked closely with E3, who did a recent analysis that's available on their website. They're a consulting firm based in San Francisco, looking at pathways to 2030 and 2050, and the costs of various ways to do that. So it's definitely being looked at and considered, and then I think will more specifically fall to the Public Utilities Commission and others, ARB, to figure out exactly what that pathway looks like.
And one other aspect of it is the CEQA consequences. I mean, as we look at housing and trying to address the state's housing needs, which is directly related to the economy, it seems that CEQA is often one of the issues that gets in the way of that. And if you overlay the question of greenhouse gases and what does that mean and how do you mitigate and what's the impact, it seems like that could be, at least in my experience up in Napa County, it's something that everybody's using to stop projects. And so is there any thought of, I mean, the whole secret question is at issue, I suppose, but I think this could be another straw on the camel's back on whether we move a lot of the projects forward that we need to move. Is there any thought about how we're going to address that?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to CEQA on its whole. I think there have been a number of important pieces of legislation and that have been passed in the last couple of years looking at how to try to remove some of those CEQA impediments to specifically to infill development and higher density development. SB 226, which does CEQA streamlining for infill, I think more also potentially with even having a larger impact is Senate Bill 743, which develops alternative metrics for evaluating transportation impacts from projects. Our office has been developing those guidelines. And I think, the hope is through those efforts that you start to be able to work away some of those barriers to doing infill development, because at the end of the day, infill is going to be critical for reducing our energy demand, reducing land consumption, reducing our water use. We know that infill development leads to lower VMT, lower energy use, lower water use, and a number of other benefits, public health benefits, et cetera. So we know that's the direction we have to be moving. And so I think the work on CEQA most recently has been trying to reduce the impediments to that. In the next year or so, or over the next 12 months, we will also be releasing a comprehensive update to the CEQA guidelines and working on that. And so I think it will continue to be an evolving issue.
So I guess, as a comment then, I guess, as we talk about greenhouse, I totally understand the need to adapt and build that infrastructure, and I'm firmly behind that. I just think we need to be careful about how we implement the target, because that can actually be counterproductive by limiting the ability to do the things that we need to do to actually adapt to what we know is coming. And so I just, whether CEQA is probably a good example, but I think this has an overlay that could be very detrimental on the state's economy if it's not managed properly.
Okay, I have, thank you, John, for taking over. I had to run out the door to get something to Dave. Jim Sperry, and then I have Pradeep.
Okay, you know, Mark had touched on some of the things I wanted to raise was the CEQA. You know, as communities try to adapt, the CEQA adds about 30-40% of the cost, and it really needs to be looked at as how we do it. But the other question I had was, when you do the update every 3 years, how are you going to look at the economic impacts, the impacts it's having on the economy, and how will that be factored into the strategies, you know, in the three-year plan?
The impacts that climate is having on the economy,
or the strategies.
I think that's a pretty open question. So far, safeguarding California has really been developed. It has not had an economic analysis component to it. It really just looks at the impacts and then what we need to do to address, you know, what are the vulnerabilities, what do we need to do to address it. And I think that will be something we'll have to think about how we want to address in now that we have this requirement to do implementation plans and to track. I think some of those issues will have to be brought up through that process. As of now, within safeguarding, it has not been considered.
Pradeep?
Thank you. Thank you, Luis, for giving us a very nice overview of a very complex, at least starting document. I see number of things that could emerge in many different ways. Some of those things I talked to you earlier before the meeting, one was the use the word all planning decisions should include that, and that would be significant impact on a lot of current regulations and current approaches to doing the planning. So I'm looking forward to how you resolve, up to what depth you are going to go to interpret that word all. Number two was the coordination with the water agencies, and I think that broad question has been brought out. Water is becoming more and more prominent in terms of thinking about even land use. We had a very good ABAC General Assembly meeting with the main theme of water and droughts and land use designs, etc., based on water situation. So as much as we are coordinating other efforts of different agencies, I think water agency should be included in those coordination in some ways. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of things that I read in the executive orders that I think the directors of these four agencies and Allison would be very interested in following up in the section of tools. The way we are doing our work right now may require some additional tools for us to tackle some of the situations according to the executive order. I have pointed out two of them right here out of your document, Luis. One is full life cycle cost accounting. It may appear to be just a simple phrase of full life cycle, but when you look in the context of the environmental impact right from the start, where you take the raw materials all the way up to the use in between manufacturing involved, it's rather a complex situation. Most of our testing of or approval of efficiencies and cost benefits do not include the whole life cycle accounting, cost accounting. So I think we may have a task to look at that. Number two, the flexible adaptive approaches for uncertain climate. Again, it's a very fully loaded phrase, and I'm going to be talking about this particular issue when we talk about the BARC documentation in the next phase of the item. But I think It brings a whole new set of quantitative analytical tools that we do not have at this time, at least to me, not visible. So we have a huge work in front of us in order to execute this executive order. So I was just wondering if that has been included in your estimate with respect to time scales and the timelines.
Yeah, so the full life cycle cost accounting line is a big one that we've had some questions on, and I think will certainly be something we grapple with on the technical advisory group as well. And I think some of the intention there, too, with that language is, you know, maybe taking a slightly simpler approach to it, but is thinking about, okay, is when you're building something or, you know, is you don't just think of the initial cost, but you consider the future climate potential protective measures, et cetera, over the life cycle of that building. And that's in a way, because or any sort of investment, to put on more equal ground. So right now we maybe just compare an upfront capital cost, and maybe it looks more expensive to build in a more resilient way, but when you factor in that over the life cycle for this one, you're going to have to later on respond to, you know, to flooding or, you know, your energy costs are going to go up as you get higher heat, those types of issues. So, you know, if we take a slightly simpler approach, I think that also was the intention here, which is to try to get a more, because you hear so often, well, it's more expensive to be, we hear this on not just on resilience, but on so many things, but when you actually take the longer term view, it's not as clear. So I think that's another way to use that language.
Yeah, I think that does, at least if that's the thinking, it is simpler than what I was thinking
yes.
about.
Yeah.
It's a comparison of all electrical vehicle, like, for example, versus a gasoline vehicle.
Exactly.
If you take into account the impact of making batteries and all this sort of thing, then it's a different equation than if you're just looking at the use of that mm-hmm. equipment. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pradeep. I just real quick just want to state that we've lost a couple members. We gained one. Thank you, Eric, for coming. We gained another one?
Mark and Eric.
Oh, Mark also joined us. Thank you. Please, nobody leave because we do have an action item, and I think we're right at a quorum right now. So, Tom?
Thank you very much for the presentation. I really appreciate it. And I just want to make a statement that I think the Brown administration is doing some fantastic work in this area and really needs to be, we need to have people recognize that you're actually pushing the envelope. And, you know, obviously sometimes you're going to have to back off a little bit, but still I think it's fantastic. And my question really is dealing with the general plan update. Can you explain when that might be in effect and when that might take, you know, when will local governments have to make the switch to understand their general plan in relation to the what's coming down?
Yeah. Well, so if we, you know, from a perspective of timing, if we have a draft out later, you know, in the summer, I think there will be an extensive public comment and outreach period because we're also developing an online tool and other pieces. You know, I think it would be the final guidelines would probably, you know, be finalized wouldn't be until 2016. I mean, as you know, there is no requirement that a city or county update their general plan other than the housing element. The guidelines don't add any new requirement like that, and we don't have the authority to do that. But really, you know, just try to be there to take advantage of the opportunity when elements or the entire plan is updated. And, of course, there are requirements of consistency, et cetera, so that when you do update, you know, it sort of kicks in a little, you know, weaves throughout the plan. But, you know, hopefully we will have them early next year, and so we would like to see them being followed, there on forward. Of course, the challenge is to make very clear in the guidelines what is required and what is recommended. And I think that's, you know, we're being very clear, you know, this is what is required of you, but here are examples of sort of the best way, that, you know, or ways that do it in different, you know, or go beyond. And so that you know, we're trying to strike that balance, of course.
Anybody else? I got Ezra. Okay, Ezra and then Mark.
Yes, thanks for being here. Some of the operational details I just want to mention. I have to pile on the CEQA relief because I think the adaptation process is the adaptation projects, including water recycling, are going to need expedited help from the state. And I think to do that, you need a clearinghouse for environmental projects of regional significance. I mean, if you can do it for arenas, you can do it for, you know, your work in climate adaptation. Number two, Prop 218 is a big problem with respect to flood control infrastructure. And we need to find a way to put that back on the ballot. I don't think anybody voted, you know, to weaken the state's adaptation infrastructure through Prop 218, but right now it's impossible to finance. Number three, amending SB 375 to address larger climate change issues like energy and water efficiency. Right now, 375 does not do anything really with reducing greenhouse gases. It can just keep up with population. It reduces it on a per capita basis. We all know there's a lot more benefits to 375 than are being articulated in this integrated land use transportation component. I think they should be over there. I think it should be overt that we are trying to do more with 375 than just integrate land use and transportation. And we get a lot of criticism about that. Thank you.
All right, and then
just based on something he said, and obviously appreciating the governor's support on this, there is a coalition of environmentalists, League of Cities, and the State Association of Counties that are working on a plan to do two things. Have flood control and stormwater fees be treated the same as water and wastewater fees and not requiring a public vote under Prop 218. So there's a pretty broad coalition already underway. What's new about it is the environmental and others on the water side to include in that the ability to tiered water rates, you know, because of that court case in Southern California, so that the changing the Constitution to allow tiered water rates for conservation. So it's married those two issues, which I think is really good. It's sort of water conservation, flood control, and stormwater.
Mark.
Thank you. My apologies for being late. Good to see you, Dr. Bedworth.
Good to see you.
I read a phrase earlier this week about how climate is what you expect, weather is what you get, and so planning for all of this is very tough. And one of the things that I've become more convinced about to that end is that there's planning and there's what you get. On VMTs, two parts to this question. One, are electric mile VMTs, how are those calculated in these reductions? And also, my statement would be to follow that, is that I think that I'm becoming more convinced that people are going to be less inclined to go onto transit as they are to relieve their guilt and get an electric or a hybrid vehicle. And of course, we're going to need more infrastructure than that. But I'm just wondering if that consideration is being thought of, that the VMTs are really not going to drop down. They might change in the nature of their production of greenhouse gases. And if so, is there incentives? Is there a calibration for electric mile VMTs?
This is an area a colleague of mine has been working on quite closely at OPR and working a lot with ARB on this issue of electric vehicle VMTs. I think right now they are there's considered no emissions associated with them. And so we've been sort of having a dialogue about that exact issue. And I'm not, you know, I don't know what direction it's going or, you know, but just how do we bring that consideration in? There are emissions in other ways, et cetera. You know, they are captured in the inventory, of course, but not maybe necessarily under the bubble of 375. And so it's a complicated accounting procedure anyway, but I think that is a conversation that is happening.
Yeah, it may be more of an infrastructure question. Well, if you're going to have if your VMTs are going to not be reduced that much because of electric vehicles, and do you have the infrastructure for that? And that's just kind of where that might be more of an infrastructure question, as I said, but I'm just wondering how the planning would go in terms of cities saying, well, you know, if we increase our VMTs, do we get a credit for that? Do our VMTs go against us? But if half of them are, or a considerable portion of them are electric, why would we be penalized for that?
Right. And I'm not aware of going into that level of detail at this point. I think the conversation is getting started. I think about, in the general plan guidelines, I think that's part of the goal too, which is to link multimodal transportation, the idea of linking health throughout and trying to really bring in some of these other benefits that you achieve through walking or biking and complete streets, et cetera. So I think, I don't think we've gotten to that level of detail yet, but I think people are thinking more and more about it. We certainly provide incentives for electric vehicles, both at the federal and state level, but we also have some incentives for taking transit and biking. How they all compare, I don't know.
Thank you. Anybody else? Anybody on staff, anything? Okay, well, I think we'd all like to thank Dr. Bedsworth for being with us this morning. Thank you. It was very informative. We look forward to having you back sometime.
Sure.
Okay. All right, so with that, we will now move on to the action item of the day, which is item 7, and I'm sure Allison will be presenting, because I'm not.
So you had a memo in your packet that had the opportunity to meet with the executive directors per your instructions at our last meeting to talk through how to structure the budget and the contribution of each member agency and their contribution to the budget. And what we came to was that MTC and the Air District would each provide 35% towards the budget, and BCDC and ABAG would agreed to a stretch goal of providing 15% of each of their agencies towards the budget. And that includes both in-kind contributions and cash contributions. And I tried to organize that as clearly as I could in the budget proposal you have before you. So what we're asking for is your approval of this budget for our next fiscal year. And I don't know if any of the executive directors want to weigh in on this or...
Seeing none of them, anybody in the group have any questions, comments? Okay, this is great. I'm looking for a motion at the... Jim?
I'll move the budget. It looks like the two guys giving up the most aren't smiling and the two guys giving up less. Well, it looked like.
He wanted to give up.
I'll move the budget, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Jim. Is there a second by Member Pierce? Anybody comments? Any objection to the motion? That motion will pass without objection. I will be happy to see you all on July 17th of 2015. We're adjourned. Jim, you made your train. We're done. We're done, right? Everybody's looking at me kind of weird, like they want more. You guys want more? You want to meet some more? That was everything. That's right.
Well, so regarding the organizational plan, we made the amendments.
Okay, so we're not adjourned. Don't leave. Go ahead.
Regarding the organizational plan, the final document you have in your packet includes the amendments that you made at our last meeting, and the motion that motion was approved at the last meeting, pending the amendments that were made. That was my understanding.
So, Jim, did you have some questions on the item?
Comments, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, are you saying it's approved with no more changes? Or?
Well, it's always open to changes, I suppose, but that if there are, that's a question.
The only thing I wanted to ask about was the...
Is your mic on, Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the officer selection where you have in there, it says the governing board strives to rotate the officers among the four agencies. Why don't we have a rotation that's included? Right now, ABAG's chairing, BCDC's vice chair, and why couldn't we have the, you know, rotation? The Air District would be next in MTC, because there's... And so I would like to propose that we have a fixed rotation in the document.
I guess you can propose that. I'm certainly not going to support that, because I think that... I like to see the chairman and the vice chairmanships being somewhat competitive and really finding, and I know I'm actually going to steal a phrase of yours, the right person for the right time. And it could be ABAG's turn, but maybe the right person for the right time is somebody from the Air District. And I wouldn't want to be bound by having to say, well, you know what, it's the rotation, so this person who never comes to the meeting is our new chairperson. That's why I wouldn't support it, Jim. But you can certainly make that, and if enough people here say it, then that's fine.
On that issue? And some of our members serve on two, or in some cases, three. So the flexible thing probably works just because we serve on multiple agencies, and we probably all make this work. Like, so if we're switching to Tom Bates, who's already been chair... You know, which hat is he wearing? Even though he may be appointed to this from one agency, he serves on several. And Jim, same with you, right? You're on Air District and MTC, so you could be wearing either hat, right?
Okay, Allison?
Just to reflect the conversation that we had amongst the executive directors and deputies, was this point of getting someone in the chairmanship position that really wants to be chair, and if it's a rotation, do you run the risk of getting someone that's not necessarily enthusiastic about serving in that role?
You never know. I tend to agree. So, Jim, any other comments? Jim, did you want to propose a motion, or we talked you off the ledge? Oh no. All right. Was there anything else in relationship to the... Or yes, Pradeep.
Just one. I'm going to talk to Allison later about some of the implications on the tools based on the discussion this morning we had about the executive order. But I can take it offline with you on that.
Okay. Anybody else? Jim, I apologize for the quick adjournment. I was just trying to get you to your train. We're going to drag this out now. No, really, are there any other comments? All right, so I don't think I need any more motions. So at this point, we are adjourned until July 17th. Thank you all very much for coming.